Good afternoon. So last time we talked about reasoning about C code or some other normal code that we would write and how that affects cache performance. And things we wanted to do to analyze that is one thing we want to know is about conflictnesses. So we want to know, well, what things in some C program I have map to the same set in my cache. So those are the things which can conflict. And even for capacity misses, we want to reason about, well, this, and this all go to that set. We're going to run out of space. That's a systematic way of finding out that that's going to happen. And the key idea is that if we look at the number of bytes per way, that's how far apart things that map to the same set. That's the distance between cache blocks that have the same set. So we just look for values which are that far apart. For example, in arrays, based on the size of each thing in the array and the array indices. And once we found things that map to the same set, we just count how many there are versus the number of ways in the set and look at the replacement policy. So like if we're accessing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, that all go to the same set and there's two slots, well, something needs to go away. And if it's a least recently used policy, we'll discover that we're always evicting the thing we're about to access next, and it's as bad as it could possibly be. Might be different with some other policy. And this general idea is how you could, like, manually, if you know what the cache looks like, count misses. We then moved on to something a bit more heuristic when we talked about cache blocking. We were reasoning mostly about capacity misses. We dealt with conflict misses. We saw that we had conflict misses come up. But we were thinking about matrix-like code. Why matrix-like code? Because that's sort of a common case where it's not obvious how to make it work well with the cache, and it's also a common case when you have a large amount of data that would be troublesome for a cache. And our reasoning was about mostly capacity misses, so we were thinking about how much stuff are we trying to stuff in the cache. And our intuition was we wanted to sort of maximize the amount of work we got done for cache miss. And later today, we'll go over sort of what that looks like, since cache blocking is a notoriously misunderstood concept in this class that we want you to get. Okay, so first, some logistical notes. So those of you who've read the schedule may know we have an exam next week. It includes everything up to and including this lecture. There will probably be less coverage of some of the cache blocking and optimization stuff, just because we have assignments on them after the exam, so we'll save our harder questions until after those assignments. And I know from that office hours for Pipe Homework 2 were very slow and frustrating to many people, and we'd like to make this better. We're not sure like what we can reasonably do to reduce the problem that, well, takes TAs a lot of time to help people, sort of things. So one thing we thought of is like maybe in future semesters we should like try to have sort of group office hours if there's like something conceptual that we can explain to people, though we know that that doesn't solve everyone's problems, and people understand what's going on as far as like how a mispredicted jump works. Though maybe some people would benefit from having that, and that could be done for multiple people at once. Maybe there's something about the tools that give you test errors that we could improve and encourage you to do different things or provide better instructions. Maybe we should try to prioritize the office hour queue better, because we know that there's some people doing things that we aren't particularly happy about, like going on the queue when they don't have a question yet. Like, it's not great for the people who do already have a question and wait until they do before committing to spending some TA time, or going on the queue and not having done some debugging work themselves that we would hope people would do to like try to figure out what's going wrong. You know, we would prefer to help the people who've looked at like what the test case is and things like that versus the people who are coming to the TA saying, here's the output of make test pipe homework 1, 2, tell me what I should do, like tell me what's going on. We'd hope that there'd be other steps you do before, you know, asking for help. But it's not clear what we should do, but welcome ideas. And yeah, I'm aware that that didn't turn out great, even though I didn't get as big a deluge of complaints as I might expect. Okay. So, yeah.
Can we see an elegant solution? solution to Pipe Homework 2 sometime?
Can I post a solution? Probably eventually. Not before Saturday because of the late deadline. Ask me next week. I might put one up. I can probably put one up with all. I have to think about whether that's going to get me in trouble in future semesters. But yeah, okay. Probably I can do that. Okay, so I mentioned that we talked about cache blocking last time. So I'm going to review that and look at it in some other ways to hopefully give you a better sort of intuition for what cache blocking is doing. And one way of viewing and accounting for the effects of cache optimizations in general, including cache blocking, is imagine we had an explicitly managed cache, that instead of being able to just have things go in the cache, you had to explicitly say, I want to access this value, let's load it into the cache first. And this is what sort of our naive code before cache blocking would have looked like with that. That we have to explicitly say load a, I times n plus k into the cache, then load b I times n plus j, and a k times n plus j. And we can look at this, and we can say, OK, so we load two values here in the loop, loads and one add plus one wall. So assuming n is pretty big, basically we have, you know, one piece of arithmetic for one load. That's sort of the ratio of operations we have. We have one load into cache for every piece of arithmetic. When we do our simplest version of cache blocking, or we just did it in K, we do three loads when n is big. This is what's going to matter, and four pieces of arithmetic. So we have 4-3 ratio for arithmetic to loading. So that means that we're doing so we have, you know, just a better ratio of loads to work. And if we think that the cache, loading something into the cache is what takes time, then that's going to give us better efficiency. Because we're doing the same amount, same computations. Computations stay the same. We're just getting a better ratio of overhead of loading things into the cache per computation. So that's one view, is that you can just do this count loads versus how much work I'm actually doing. And we know the work stays the same when we're doing the optimization. So it's just a matter of what gives us the best. And as we do more and more blocking, as long as load into the cache doesn't fail because we run out of space in our cache or have conflicts, we're going to get better and better efficiency. So up until we fill up the cache, we're going to improve that ratio more and more, and we're going to get better performance. So this is one way of analyzing why cache blocking is helping us. This sort of count how many times we have to load things into the cache at all. And the easiest way for me to do that is this sort of, let's imagine we had to load explicitly before we used it. You know, which, you know, we don't do in our real systems. People have built computers where the caches work that way, where they don't have, where you have to actually say, explicitly say, load this value into the cache and then access it that way. But that's not our machines. But we can imagine what it would be like if we had to say that. Another way of looking at it is to analyze the spatial and temporal locality. Because we know that that's what caches take advantage of, so we can just say, how have we improved spatial and temporal locality, or hurt spatial and temporal locality? And here I'm doing the blocking I and K, because that's going to give us more examples to look at here. And we're going to look at each of the terms of the addition. And remember that before we did cache blocking, this was the old inner loop, was just this, and we were going, not skipping k by 2, but k by 1. And I'm not by 2, but I by 1. So in the old inner loop, we accessed each bij once, And then we have to go through the entire J loop and the entire I loop, so that's n squared iterations, before we did it again. So that's basically the worst possible temporal locality, because we waited the maximum, pretty much, possible time between accesses to the same B element. We can do the same analysis for AKJ. And AKJ, we had to wait until we had an iteration of the J loop until we accessed it again, when we had our, remember, our original inner loop. And now we access it twice before we do that. Access it twice, and then we have n iterations of the loop. So we made the temporal locality in Bij and AKJ a little bit better by doing this blocking. And this is, we can think of this as being where our gain comes from. We can also look at the temporal locality in Aik. So remember, this is, again, this first line was our old inner loop. And so we access that n times, and then never ever again. That's all the times we need to access it in the old version. And now, after we do this, we still access it n times. But actually, the temporal locality is slightly worse, because we're doing more work, more other accesses in between each access. So we access, you know, this is, we access this, then this, then this. And that, the old loop, like basically every three memory accesses was to this Aik. And now we access this, this, and this, and then this, six, and so on. So every 12 memory accesses is to that Aik element. So the temporal locality is worse, but it's not worse in a way which actually ends up mattering. It's not that worse because our cache can fit all this stuff. But eventually, as we expand this, this amount that will get worse is going to hurt us. Like if we, instead of blocking in 2x2, we blocked in like n by n, obviously that's the same as changing the loop order. So in the extreme, this is going to be a problem. But we made the temporal locality in Aik slightly worse, but it's still pretty good. And in exchange for doing that, we made the temporal locality, which didn't exist in Bij and Akj, a little bit better. So that's the sort of primary effect of cache blocking from the perspective of where's the locality, is that usually we started out with something where we had some very good locality, but we also had some very bad locality. And now we end up with something where we have no completely great locality, but no really bad locality. You've made it all okay. And this also holds true with spatial locality. So we didn't talk that much last time about how cache blocking has affected spatial locality, but that's a big reason why it's beneficial. So in Bij, before blocking, we had perfect spatial locality. And now we have slightly less spatial locality, but again, this is slightly less bad, just like with Aik. This is not a big effect. And we have slightly less because these two things are Bij and Bi plus 1j are pretty far apart from each other in memory. And previously, we would access them, you know, not close together in time. But now we are. So the spatial locality is a little worse. And the same is true for Akj. But if you look for Aik, we previously had essentially no spatial locality because we would access Aik and Ai plus 1k, which are far apart. Now, those would be our consecutive accesses. And now we access Aik and Aik plus 1 together. So now we have some spatial locality. So again, we've traded off making the spatial locality worse, slightly worse, for two of our terms. But we've gotten a place where we had no spatial locality, and now we have some. Yes? Question? Yes, that is a typo. And if we have a bigger block size, we'll have a greater effect here, and we can make the, you know, locality basically the same goodness for all of them. And so this is one way you can think about what cache blocking is doing, is that it's improving all our bad localities. And we can't improve all the localities all at the same time, but the one things we're making worse, we're not making that much worse. You know, because we have only a relatively limited number of values that we need to keep in the cache. It will fit, it will work out. And so when we generalize this, so we could look at it either in the sort of what is the locality overall, or we can do our load counting. And when we do our general load counting, we just, we find out that, as when we have a squarish block, we get basically the same sort of ratios for everything. That we have made the locality about as good for each of the terms. And that usually ends up giving us best performance, something around there, not guaranteed. Maybe some terms more important if you have a different type of problem than squaring. But that's sort of our intuition as for why we're going to have, approximately square blocks. The idea is that we're sort of evenly distributing our locality, where previously we had some very good locality in one term and pretty bad in some others. And now we're getting, if K, I, and J are close together, we're having roughly the same amount of work per mess. And we'll put another way, roughly the same amount of temporal locality for everything, and hopefully similar spatial locality. Yeah?
Can we go over an example?
And
maybe an office hours?
Maybe, I don't know, this is an very concrete example, and I guess this counting isn't entirely obvious here, but basically each AIK we use n squared times, because we use it with there are n squared items, and each of one we use k times in this loop, right? And so we have n squared computations, and every k of them is a miss, basically. Because we have a miss for every k, yeah, because we use it k times for, I guess, I'll do the example we actually use k times. So this, for example, we use k times, and then we go move on. And that's where I'm getting the n squared over k. So each of those n squared items, I use k times before I have a miss. Yeah. But I think, you can probably do the sort of micro calculation. And in practice, when you do cache blocking, you kind of just measure what happens, because there are effects we're not accounting for here, like conflict misses. I'm sort of just counting, assuming things fit in the cache, and that's not really guaranteed. So the intuition is that squarish chunks work best because they make it equally bad for our parts. And the idea is that square chunk fits in the cache, that we load that chunk in the cache and do as much as possible. And I hope I didn't make an error there. So we can think of it as maximum calculations per load. And that's going to happen most with a square chunk, because we use, that sort of maximizes the use overall for everything, collectively, even though it doesn't maximize any individual thing. Okay. So any other questions about cache blocking? I'm sorry, I don't have I don't know what a different example that I could quickly use would look like.
That's fine.
Okay, so that's cache blocking. So this seems like, by doing this with a big K, I, and J, doing it with a nice square block, if we choose that block so it's almost the whole size of our L1 cache, that's going to give us basically our best possible performance. That when we look at our loop, where conceptually loading, loading values equal to the size of the cache and doing all the work we can possibly do with that. So that should improve performance. And well, we have some graphs, So last time we showed you a bunch of graphs. So here's the improvement in the miss rate. So those of you who are paying very close attention to the lecture on Tuesday should have noticed that we pulled a bit of a trick. That we started by showing you cycles, and then we started showing you miss rates. And if you're thinking carefully, you might be suspicious. Wait a moment, why wouldn't you show us cycles? Isn't that what really matters? We want it to be faster, take less time. So shouldn't you show us time, not number of misses? And that's because, there are some not great things going on. So here in miss rate, we see that the blocked version generally does a lot better. We have these outliers, which are probably from conflict misses, which become a bit worse in the block code because the spatial locality isn't as good. So for certain sizes, because things are close to powers of two, we end up paying for that. And for the other sizes, it doesn't matter. But what is actual performance like? And there the story is not so great. So this is the cycles per multiplier add. And we see that the block code is a bit slower. Even though this is the same code, same measurements that had less cache misses. And looks like it's going to have less cache misses just going on to infinity. So what happened? Why? And this is the same range, by the way, 0 to 500. So what happened here? Do that. And it has to do with how efficient my other work in the loop was. So I have a version where I optimized the arithmetic. I didn't change what was accessed in memory. It's accessing the same things in the same order. I just optimized how the arithmetic worked and a bit how the loads worked, loading the same stuff and storing the same stuff. And now, when I get a big enough size, the blocked version is better. Though not better by very much. And you might say, if it's only that much better, why did we bother? We're going to talk about what did I do to make this faster? And basically what I did is change my compiler options. So part of the reason we don't see a big effect here is that I'm showing you the less interesting part. Where our cache performance really matters is when we have big sizes. And you might say 500 by 500, that's pretty big, or 1,000 by 1,000, that's pretty big, but not on the system I was testing. So here's some values for bigger sizes, where n goes up to 10,000. And if you think about what, say, 5,000 by 5,000, 5,000 times 5,000 elements is, that's very big. And you have to remember we're doing 5,000 computations per element. So these take a long time to run, which is why you do not have points for every possible n, because I was not that patient. And we have this region I've marked in red here where the matrix fits in my L3 cache. So on the system I was testing this, my L3 cache was 8 megabytes. So that's pretty big. And when things fit in the L3 cache, there wasn't much of a difference. And that was because, yes, I was getting less L1 cache misses and probably L2 cache misses, but the L3 cache was fast enough that it didn't really matter. But when things stopped fitting in the L3 cache, I was getting L3 cache misses that I avoided by doing this blocking. And then I have this sort of factor of two performance difference. And this is for the optimized code. So any questions about this phenomenon? Okay, so let's talk a bit about why did optimizing my loop suddenly make cache blocking better when before it wasn't? And this doesn't actually make sense if you think about how our pipeline processor works. Our pipeline processor, this wouldn't happen. And the reason why is if we have cache misses, we stall the pipeline. And since I'm accessing memory in the same order in both cases, we're going to have the same number of cache misses. So the same number amount of stalling. And those are going to be extra time we have to spend. So the reason why we saw this reverse effect is because modern processors don't work that way. So the optimizations I did were all about, you know, sort of instruction efficiency. I did things with less instructions. I did less loads, but each load was of more data. I loaded multiple things at once. I ended up using instructions that added multiple things at once, so I did less instructions. And I also simplified the address computations a little bit. But none of these are things which change the number of cache misses. So if we imagine that waiting for a cache miss is a fixed cost we add on, then while the cost is the same, I should see the same, you know, I should see that it started off, you know, the same ordering, but the ordering changed. So what was happening? And this is because our processors are really out of order and multiple issue, that they do multiple instructions at once and they don't do them in order. And this is a case where this affects our performance in a visible way. So what you can think of as happening is when we had slow arithmetic, when we did these multiplies and adds in an inefficient way, that's what mattered. That we were spending all of our time waiting for multiplies and adds to happen, and while they were happening, our processor was also doing loads in parallel. So it was loading some things, adding and multiplying some things at the same time. And as long as the multiplies and adds were too slow to keep up with the loads, it didn't matter how long the loads took. So when I was doing my additions and multiplications inefficiently, yeah, I have these long loads because of a cache miss, but it doesn't actually make my program any slower because I'm waiting for all these multiplies and adds to finish. That's what actually mattered. And when I shrunk these multiplies and adds, then I was having these loads strung together and the performance of the loads started mattering. Or, and especially when I had L3 misses, which take a lot longer, so the loads stretched out more. But we have this sort of effect where initially the actual problem was the performance of my multiplies and adds. So it didn't mean the cache doesn't matter, it just means it didn't matter yet. When I fixed that bottleneck, well, now the cache started mattering. And this is a thing you'll see all the time when you're worried about making code fast, that something will be determining why your code is slow. You fix it, and the thing you should do next is not continue working on that something, because something else is now the problem. So because once I fixed these multiplies, now it's taking more time. Once I got them below the time of the loads, it wouldn't matter if I made them faster and faster. My program would be just as slow until I fixed the loads. So you can think of this as sort of optimization whack-a-mole. You know, you fix one problem and now something else, which previously didn't matter. You did all this cache optimization, didn't do anything. All of a sudden, it starts mattering. This is a common theme when you see optimization problems. So any questions on this sort of bottleneck phenomenon, sort of generally why we could have cache blocking sometimes matter and sometimes not? Okay, so I told you that the big thing I did is I changed my compiler flags. And by changing my compiler flags, my compiler managed to do the loads with less instructions. So, you know, same data, less instructions. In fact, it loaded, you know, load, you know, 128 bytes at a time versus bits at a time versus 32 bits at a time. You know, so it did a quarter of the loads, but it's loaded the same amount of data from the same places. And do the adds and multiplies with less instructions. There happen to be instructions that we'll talk about after the exam, which add or multiply multiple numbers at the same time. And it simplified the address computations a little bit. But these were things that my compiler did for me, so like, what do compilers do? We want to reason about that, because if you wish want to make code fast, well, you should use the compiler. Like, the compiler can do a lot of stuff, apparently, that has a big effect, and we want to take advantage of that, and we want to know, well, when is that not going to be good enough? When do I have to intervene? So let's look at things that compilers do. So here is some unoptimized code. So I have a function that just sums up an array, and my unoptimized code here is very bad. My compiler has decided that we're going to get my I times 8 from the to compute the array index, get A from the stack, add it to the offset, then move that where we know that you can do this with one move instruction. Then we're going to add that to a value on the stack, which we're not keeping in a register because the compiler is not being very smart about it, and we're going to increment I on the stack, not in the register. And then we're going to move that I from the stack into a register, so just so we can do a comparison. So this is like really silly code. This is what our compiler does by default, because it's using a strategy that always works. It keeps everything on the stack, because, well, keeping stuff on the stack never is wrong. And it just moves it every time. It has some more advanced stuff you can enable optionally that fixes this problem. But this assembly is pretty silly. So let's look at some more optimized assembly. So here, I'm running GCC 5.4 with the capital OS, which is optimized for size. So this is trying not to produce fast code, but small code. I usually find this produces the most readable assembly code because, well, we naturally try to write small code, and this does that. So here we set, we have EDX as our loop index and EAX as our results, and we do the straightforward thing and adding things up in one instruction and the most straightforward comparison. This is nice, straightforward assembly, just like the sort you would write by hand. And, you know, seems like probably the most efficient way of doing things, but if we look at what happens when we ask our compiler to do a different type of optimized version, it does something very clever. This is with O2. So here, we're optimizing for size. And it's doing, like, this is basically the most compact thing you can do. And you might say, well, that's probably the most efficient way of writing the code. And if you run with O2, someone who wrote this compiler had some different ideas on how you can make that just a little bit faster. So the compiler does this non-obvious transformation here, where they make a pointer to A, and they compute the address of the end of the array, and they change the loop to be a loop that compares the pointer and then does adds the pointer and increments the pointer. And this gets rid of I. So the whole advantage is that we got rid of I entirely. And I guess actually they do, sorry, this is n minus 1. So they got rid of I entirely and therefore saved an increment. And so they made this slightly more efficient, assuming we have a non-trivial number of loop iterations. This is not an obvious like transformation to do, and not so nice to do by hand, but this is something our compiler is really good at finding. Someone wrote some code to find out, oh, it's common for people to access arrays in a loop. Let's turn that into moving a pointer around. The compiler has code to find this pattern, get rid of the index, and just manipulate the pointers to avoid make the address calculation simpler, and also, you know, possibly eliminate a whole variable in the increment, and it managed to work here. And that's really clever. So, and this is the sort of thing we can see compilers do all the time. It's the type of thing they're good at. So we want to focus on optimizations that compilers aren't good at. That, you know, things that we as humans can look at code and say, yeah, that's something I should do, where compilers might not do that for some reason. No. This is not to say that if you want fast code, you should turn on the optimization options, you should explore what your compiler can do for you, but there's classes of things that your compiler is going to be bad at, and that you are not going to find so hard. And the reason for this is the compiler has some sort of design limitations. So we're going to talk about entities. So one of them is the compiler needs to generate correct code. It needs to generate code which does the same thing as what you wrote. So that doesn't seem like a real limitation. Of course it needs to do the right thing. Like, so do I when I optimize code. But it needs to do this even in corner cases which you, a human looking at the code, know doesn't really matter. So, for example, here, the compiler needed to worry about what if n is less than 0. That's a valid thing you could call this code with. You could call this code with n is negative 15, and that needs to work correctly. You, a human looking at this code, know that that better not matter. No one better be calling this with a negative n. But that's not what the code says. The code says if n is negative, this returns 0. And the compiler faithfully made sure that happened with this special case at the beginning of the function. Which you probably writing this by hand would not write there and just say, don't pass a negative n, what are you doing? But it needs to worry about that sort of corner case, where even you, a human, know it's not a real thing. Another limitation compilers have is that they're bad at looking across methods to do optimizations. There are two reasons for this. So one reason is, well, you're compiling a file at a time, the method might be in a different file. The compiler can't really look at the method in the other file and figure out what's going on because it doesn't know what that method is yet. It might change by the time you produce the executable. So it has to produce code that assumes the method might change to do anything. Another reason is sort of a performance one. So many of the optimizations compilers are doing are kind of expensive. So like to transform array lookups into variables, the compiler needs to say, what's an array? Where are all the places it's accessed with an index? Are they the same? It needs to do a bunch of analysis over the entire loop. If the compiler extends that analysis to include all functions called in the loop and functions they call and so on, nesting deeper and deeper, you can quickly have to look at a whole lot of code to try to do optimizations. And usually as a heuristic, compilers will not go all the way doing that just because it would make your compilation really slow. If you have a loop which calls like a string copy and looks in the code for string copy, and you know, we can imagine that you could easily have your 3-line loop involves the compiler looking over like several hundred lines to say, is there some pattern where I can make this pointer better? You know, and all the other sort of things it's looking for. So to manage that complexity, compilers often avoid looking across functions and methods. Doesn't mean they have to, but it often is a decision they've made heuristically to help performance. Another thing compilers can't do is they don't know what inputs and outputs are, even typically. So even in the case where it's not a corner case, like the compiler looking at this code doesn't know, is a typical N3, is a typical N a million? It doesn't know that. So if there's optimizations which benefit from knowing, for example, how many times a loop runs, then the compiler can't really tell. It needs to assume something safe as far as what the typical case is, and not do some optimization which gets you in, you know, a lot slower if it's wrong. Another thing compilers are bad at doing is that they don't have a precise notion of what your code space versus size trade-offs are. So when I pass optimize for size, I'm telling the compiler explicitly, make my program as small as possible, please. But usually you have some sort of different notion. Like, you'd be unhappy if your simple sum up this array program ended up being like a 3 megabyte executable, even if it was slightly faster than the 100 kilobyte executable version. Probably not like that. And the compiler can't really tell when it should make that sort of trade-off. So for optimizations which would make your program much, much bigger, the compiler is often going to err on the side of not doing that because it doesn't know that A, the code is important enough to do that, and B, that you would be happy having your executable be twice as big, which could really happen if it did it all over your program, even for code which is not executed very often. And an example of a case where this comes up, if you think of cache blocking, that was an optimization we did which made our code way bigger. Right? We wrote all this extra loop management code to do cache blocking. That's going to take up a lot more space in our executable. If you want your executables to be small, you wouldn't be happy if your compiler did that sort of transformation to every loop you had. Okay, so let's talk about probably the nastiest problem that makes it hard for compilers to do optimizations you expect compilers to do. And this is something known as aliasing, which is where two things have the same name, have different names, sorry. There's two names for the same thing. So the textbook gives this example. We have a function which takes two pointers, and you might say, well, let's just multiply py points 2 times 2, and then store that in px. And this will save accessing py twice from memory. We can just put it in a register, and accessing px twice from memory. So that seems more efficient. That's something you probably think you could do as a human, is just turn this into star px equals star py plus times 2. But it turns out that that is something a compiler absolutely, definitely cannot do. So this code loads py, adds py to itself to multiply it times 2, and then adds that to px. That is wrong. That is code the compiler is not allowed to generate. And the reason why is you, clever programmer who's breaking this function, get to call it with two pointers to the same thing. So here, we take x plus equals x to get 2, and then again x plus equals x to get 4. The result is 4. Our optimized version takes x times 2 to get 2, adds it to 1, gets 3. So it's a different answer. Clearly the compiler can't do this because that's not how that C code works. So you looking at a human know, someone who wrote this function probably didn't mean to handle that case. And this is a real challenge for compilers. So compilers would need to worry about this all the time. So every time you write an optimization for a compiler, you might think you do some clever transformation. You need to make sure that that transformation doesn't get in trouble if two pointers happen to be pointing to different parts of the same thing, or like a pointer to something and a local variable happens to point to a local variable. You need to make sure that doesn't happen, and so on. You need to handle all those cases just in case you set the pointers up in the worst possible way. So you said, well, you might think this is a pretty contrived case. That's not a real function you'd write. It's kind of silly. Does this really happen in real code? And the answer is yes, all the time. So here's an example of a code with an aliasing problem. So what's the aliasing problem? What's the thing the compiler needs to worry about being pointed to the same thing?
Multiplying
Yeah. Okay. So resultant matrix could be pointing to the same thing. And what problem would that cause? Okay. Yeah, so it could end up being that we add something here that ends up being an operand here later on. And in particular, there's an optimization we would like the compiler to do, which is we would like this to be kept in a register. We like this result of row to be kept in a register while we're accessing it, rather than going to memory each time. Yes, it's going to be a cache hit, but it's still going to be slower, more instructions. We'd like it to be kept in a register. So the question is, can the compiler do that? And the answer is no, because it needs to worry that result of row might be one of those matrix elements. Because not only could result, could be equal to matrix plus some offset. Like, it could be in the middle, there could be different parts of the same array overlapping in various ways. And the compiler needs to generate code that does what we wrote. You're not. You, a human looking at this, can say, no one ever intended to call this function with result and matrix overlapping. That would be stupid. But that's not what the compiler can say. The compiler needs to do what it's told to do. So a trick we can use to give the compiler the information it needs is to explicitly have a local variable to deal with the aliasing problem. So rather than writing the result directly, I write a local variable. And the compiler has an easy way of knowing that that doesn't alias with matrix. And that's because I never took a pointer to it. So I can't possibly have a pointer to it anywhere. And so in this other version, the compiler can easily put the sum in a register and keep it in a register like we want. And this really makes a performance difference. So this is cycles per addition. And you can see that we have this sort of fixed performance difference from the loads we're saving. Getting a little more efficiency in the long run by telling the compiler enough information to know that it can, in fact, keep that in a register by basically allocating a local variable, which obviously can be kept in a register instead of accessing the destination directly. Another thing that this sort of rearranging of code does is it makes it easier for the compiler to see other optimizations, and for us perhaps to see other optimizations. And this is going to be true of a lot of the stuff we talked about today. So if I compile with 0.3, I get this huge difference. And what happened is that there was some more advanced optimization related to doing multiple things at once in the loop that the compiler figured out how to do as long as it knew it didn't have to worry about aliasing. But when it had to worry about aliasing, it couldn't figure out how to do it effectively. Because it didn't know that, in fact, I couldn't be changing the result all the time in the middle of the loop with the separate variable. It knew, okay, this is independent of that matrix, it's fine. So you might say, well, okay, that's a nice example. Can't the compiler kind of work around this and just check whether they overlap? And the answer is yes. So the compiler could generate code like this. This is a real thing that some compilers do sometimes. So they detect there's something that depends on aliasing, so they generate code to check, do these things overlap? If so, let's do the safe version, otherwise let's do the faster version. But there's obvious trade-offs here. If you're concerned about the size of your executable, you'd be pretty unhappy if every loop looked like this when the compiler compiled it. Therefore, making all your loops have two copies of the loop code for the loop and making your executable basically twice as big. And so that's one reason why the compiler just won't do this for you automatically. Another reason is that figuring this out is a bit non-trivial. Like, it's not that trivial for you to do as a human. Like, it's also not trivial to write logic to reliably figure out this is the bounds I need as a compiler. But yes, this is something that can be done, and some compilers will, like, in some circumstances, generate this sort of check, especially if you ask for the quote-unquote higher optimization levels. They'll generate both versions and have a check to see which one you can use safely, and so on. Okay, so this aliasing problem comes up particularly when we're talking about code like this code we use to demonstrate cache blocking. So if you think about what we started with, which was loop orders. Remember, we said the Kij loop order was better than the Ijk loop order. And you could imagine the compiler might have some way of figuring out which is better by itself, by like knowing what the locality is and doing some analysis. But that's actually really problematic to use, because the compiler needs to worry about silly situations like B and A are pointers to parts of the same array. So it cannot do this, because if B and A point to parts of the same array, these do different things. They have different results. We as a human know that's ridiculous. You would never do that. But the compiler needs to worry about it. And this is a reason why, if you want to do cache blocking, you probably need to do it yourself, rather than having the compiler do it for you. So another case where cache blocking and aliasing comes up is if we think about sort of our expanded code here for, this is the 2x2 cache block. I meant to do plus equals 2, plus plus. Then we would like the compiler to keep this value in a register so we don't load it again here. That would be a good thing. But our compiler can't really do that, because it's going to worry about aliasing. What if bi times n, I plus 1 times n plus j is the same thing? What if they're pointers to different arrays offset such that they overlap and we happen to be accessing one than the other through different pointers? It has to worry about that. So it can't actually easily keep that in the register, even though that's obviously going to be most efficient rather than having a bunch of extra instructions to access memory. You know, even though it's obviously a cache hit, that's, you know, it's still faster to use a register. So a common pattern when writing code, like you see with cache blocking, is to explicitly put things in local variables like we saw earlier. And this is going to tell the compiler, you can keep aik in a register. You know, we're essentially saying, keep it in the register. I'm allocating a register, telling you to put it in a register now. And I'm, you know, making sure that, well, you have to have the same value even if it's changed by assigning to b. And this is often known as register blocking. You can think about it with choosing a block of variables not to put in the cache, but to put in the registers. And so this is a pattern you'll commonly see in any sort of code where we're worried about this sort of aliasing, and we have sort of repeated use of values that, you know, if we want to avoid the redundant load cost, we're going to, A, move any repeated loads outside of loops and create a variable to tell the compiler something's not aliased. Whenever we have an aliasing problem, the simplest solution for us as a coder is to have a local variable that we never take a pointer to, so the compiler can just say, nope, there's no pointers to this, because you'd have to make one. And it can keep it in a register, presumably. Even if it puts it on the stack, it still knows you never took a pointer to it. So any questions about, you know, this kind of strategy? Okay, so one aside. So C and C++ have a feature which is theoretically supposed to deal with aliasing. So this is a keyword called restrict. And you can put the restrict keyword on a pointer, and it says, I promise this pointer doesn't alias another pointer in the code that I'm using it in. And if your promise is wrong, that's undefined behavior. You're not allowed to do that. Okay. Straightforward enough, so it seems kind of dangerous, because the compiler's not going to do the right thing. But assuming you mark it right, seems like it should allow the compiler to do all these sorts of optimizations we saw earlier, which it couldn't do because it didn't know that things overlapped. In practice, I found that it generally doesn't help very much. Compilers aren't very good at using this hint. Also, there are some problems, like the compiler, you know, can't really tell that AIK and AKJ aren't the same thing and might worry about that. But yeah, it just doesn't seem good enough to actually help. As far as how compilers have implemented it, they just haven't put enough effort into taking advantage of it. But it's something which exists, and it's supposed to solve this problem. It just usually doesn't. So let's talk about some different problems. Things which aren't about sort of the issue of generating the right code, but issues about whether compilers are looking into methods or have the same trade-offs that we do. Let's look at something that is surprisingly inefficient if we do this in a straightforward way. So here I have a function which sums with a limit. So I go up to 10,000, and if I get to 10,000, I stop. So I have this simple utility function to do the sum, which I call repeatedly in the loop. So in the straightforward code, calling this function, that's going to requires us to do something. And so what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to move the values to the registers, you know, the arguments into their appropriate registers, and call. The function we call is actually going to have to return. We're going to have to possibly move its return value out of the way if we aren't clever enough to have RAX be the next thing we use. So we end up with sort of code like this to set up the function, so three extra instructions, plus the return, plus maybe something to move the return value. So that's, you know, it's a relatively small cost, like four instructions. But if you think about the common case for this add instruction, it's usually an add, a compare, and a conditional jump. Like, that's the actual work we're doing. Like, it's actually a very, very short function. So now we have four instructions of overhead to do three instructions of actual work. So that ends up being a big cost. And one way we can make sure the compiler doesn't have that overhead is we can get rid of the function call, which is known as inlining. We're putting it in line in the function. So this has the advantage that we got rid of those extra instructions. And we also have this sort of hidden advantage that we make more registers be free. Previously, the compiler needed to worry about all the color-saved registers, needing to like move those on the stack. Now, those are free to use. So this can potentially give us a big advantage, especially if we have like lots of things we're accessing from an array or something in a loop. It's always faster. And the biggest thing is that we're making our code bigger, and that can make it slower. So I talked about the inconvenience of having like your 2 megabyte executable, but we also have the problem that we have an instruction cache, and if we want our fetch to be fast, our instruction cache better be where we're getting our instructions. But if we make our code big enough, we're gonna run out of space there. And by having tons of copies of a function that we use lots of places, well, we're making our code a lot bigger. And so this is why our compilers don't just do this automatically for us. So even in the cases where they can, you know, they can inline, but they will do this conservatively to avoid making your code a lot bigger. Because if they just inline all the time, that's probably going to make your code slower because you'll run out of instruction cache space. If you just like every single function call, including the functions that function calls, like you inline several levels deep, that's going to make your code a lot bigger. And most of that code isn't run enough that it really matters that you're removing the calls and returns versus the cost of having your instruction cache filled up with stuff all the time. That isn't used as much. You may have worse locality in your instruction cache. So usual heuristics that compilers will use. One is if the function is small enough, inline it. So in the case of our function, which has like four instructions, that's a pretty good candidate for inlining because you're not going to make the code much bigger. If it has like 100 instructions, probably not so great, even though inlining might help performance a lot of the time. But it's going to guess that that's not worth the cost. Another case that will commonly inline is if it can prove the function is called exactly once, it can get rid of the function definition and just put it where it's called. And this is something compilers will do for static functions that can't be called from other files. We'll just put it where it's called, get rid of the actual function definition, because that doesn't waste any more space. It uses the same amount of space you'd use otherwise. And compilers generally won't inline across .o files. And this is just because, when you're making the .o file, that's when the compiler typically decides what assembly to generate. If it doesn't know what the other function is at that time, it can't inline it. So compilers do have options to do inlining across .o files, but this dramatically changes how compilation works. This is something called link time optimization. It has the big disadvantage of making the linking phase now involves optimization and like new code generation, so it's a lot slower. So that's sort of the downside of doing that. So in addition to these heuristics, some compilers have explicit hints you can give to say, please try to inline this function, or please don't inline this function. The form of the hints varies between compilers, but this is a very common feature. And so if you want something inline, you could just tell the compiler, please do it for me, rather than having to write the code by hand. Since it's easy for the compiler to do, the only issue is whether it actually is helpful. That's what's keeping the compiler from doing it all the time. So questions about function inlining? Okay. So we're going to talk about sort of a little category of optimization which probably has the biggest performance effect of any ones we talked about. And the only one we're going to talk about, which is a big O improvement. So everything else we talked about is possibly a very big constant factor improvement, but not asymptotic. But this one is. So what is the problem with this code? Okay, so we're running string len. So this is, run every time. And what does the string len method do?
Does it iterate through the entire string and count how many characters?
Yeah, so it iterates through the string, and it has to do that because it knows how long the string is by where the null terminator is. It doesn't have some faster way of knowing. So this ends up being every time, it's big O of n times n times, so this ends up being an n squared loop. And you might say, could our compiler figure this out? Maybe our compiler can realize, that string len is going to return the same thing every time and put the result in a register and be done with it. But that's problematic because the compiler to do that needs to know what string len does. And we talked that one of the things that compilers are bad at doing is looking at code in other files and other .o files and so on, and looking across methods. So the compiler is not especially likely to do that. Maybe it has some special case for things like this, but probably it won't, just because string len is just, for the most part, a function. And if you don't know what the function does, you need to assume that even if you pass the same string, it's going to give you different results each time, because maybe our implementation of string len is return a random number. As a human, that's not the case. The compiler might have to assume that. And so you can easily fix this manually by explicitly getting that value into a variable outside the loop. You know, and now you have a big O of n loop. But this sort of problem is something which can occur naturally with things other than string len, and it's probably more likely to be a problem with functions that aren't part of the standard library, because the compiler might have some special cases for those. And, you know, something that you have to give the indication by hand of how to deal with it. Okay. So here, we have another case where we can have some redundant work. We're doing lots of comparisons. So we're doing n comparisons here, and n comparisons here. And there's a way to do this with less comparisons. So what should I do to avoid some comparisons? So I'm doing some work where I should know the result already, but I'm just computing it over and over again. And it's not big O bad, because I'm doing 2n comparisons and I'm still going to need to do a lot. What's an observation I can make that will help me avoid comparisons? Yeah. So you're saying that I should use amount as the start. So you want to start at amount and go to where? So we have.
Wait, okay.
Think you have might have okay. There's a way of doing it, but I'm not sure it's not the most straightforward. But there's something involving. That it is the right kind of observation to make. So basically, this is for the first n minus amount elements of the array, we do this case. And for the last amount elements, we do the second case. And the way this code is written, the most natural thing that would happen is that we would, every time we check, are we done? We check, are we in the first case or the second case for every element. We could restructure the code like this. So we do, let's do the first case, then let's do the second case, and avoid a comparison for every loop iteration by observing that we go from the first case to the second. So this sort of thing, you know, eliminates some comparisons. It's also something which exposes probably more optimizations. Like it's more obvious if we have, like, if we can keep things in registers, or like if the compiler can like use a pointer to iterate through arrays from this version than the original version. Because we have, you know, more straightforward code and possibly more obvious to you if you're doing those by hand. So one final type of optimization has to do with loops. And we'll be looking a lot at loops, especially after the exam, because they're the most important things to optimize. So here is a transformation known as loop unrolling. So I have a loop which is summing up. You can think of this as sum plus equals AI, like we showed you earlier. And I have 2 and 2. So I have 4 instructions of overhead. And here, I'm doing sum plus equals AI, and plus equals AI plus 1. And I still have 4 instructions of overhead. So I'm doing twice as much work, you know, with 6 instructions as I was doing with 5. If we think of the summing up in the array is the real work. Now I do have a bit of a problem. Are these two loops equivalent to each other? Do they do the same thing? I just set RDI, RDX to the same values, do I get the same result? Yeah, so if, for as an example, let's say we start RDX at 1, then we do 2 additions in the second case and 1 in the first. And probably in our original code loop, the original array, we'd be going off the end of the array. So that seems pretty bad. So we actually need to have some case, we need to do some adjustments, and we need to handle what if there's an odd element left out. You know, how to handle that. So what we'll end up with is this is sort of the equivalent C code with the extra case handled. So we do pairs of values together, and because we have the same sort of loop overhead, incrementing the index, comparing the values, we save some instructions. We're doing a lot more work, you know, per instruction, basically. But we have to handle what if we're, you know, if it's an odd number of elements, we need to handle the odd element that we didn't deal with. And we also need to adjust the indexes slightly so we don't go over the end of the array when we're doing each pair. So we do all the pairs, and then we do one. And this ends up being faster just because we have less instructions. So we're just literally doing less work. And we can extend this, so we can do this with 4 elements at a time. We take 4 elements, 4 elements, 4 elements, and then we take whatever's left over at the end. So like function inlining, this is something which is easy for compilers to do. And even though it's easy for compilers to do, they don't do it very much. So compilers are good at figuring out, I can, you know, there's this index, I can do this multiple times. But, you know, it's not always beneficial. If our loop, if our n is like 3 or 7, then this code is not much faster. Because we have the checking for the special case, you know, that's gonna be a lot of extra time. And also, this makes our code bigger, makes it a lot bigger. If we're doing this for a loop of like 15 instructions, you want 4 copies of those 15 instructions, like that quickly adds up to running out of instruction cache space if you just did it all over the place. So compilers don't do this very aggressively. They only do it in very obvious cases, and even then typically only with higher optimization settings. So it's something that you can benefit from doing yourself. And it does help performance. So I did this unrolling of, you know, that I showed you earlier with 992 elements. That number is chosen because it fits in my L1 cache. So I warmed up the cache to make sure all of those elements were in the cache first. So there's no cache misses in this benchmark. This is measuring everything's in cache. And I unrolled the loop once, twice, did pairs of values, quadruples of values, and so on, all powers of 2, so they don't have any leftover case to deal with. I measured the number of instructions executed per element of the array that we were summing, and the number of cycles per element. And you can see that as I added more and more amount of enrolling, the number of instructions per element keeps going down. But my performance is not the same way. That there's this wall my performance hits, which our book calls the latency bound. And that's sort of where we end up. So after the exam, we'll talk about what's that latency bound, how do I reason about it, what can we do about it. That's sort of what happens. So you think if you counted instructions that you'd end up at this case where you get, you know, it just keeps getting better and better. But that's not how our processors work. It has to do with the fact that our processors do things in parallel. So that's what I have for today. So next time, we will talk about our exam review. So if you want me to answer questions about things that might be on the exam, you should have questions to ask. Otherwise, I might not talk about the topic you want reviewed.